afternoon, and welcome to We the People Radio. My name is Aaron Ryan.
And I'm Bill Cundiff.
Right, try that again.
I'm Bill Cundiff.
He was Bill Cundiff the first time, only no one knew.
Silent Sam.
And I'm Bob Martin.
Oh, my gosh. And we have our guest with us.
Lauren, introduce yourself.
I'm Lauren Spivak, the free market warrior.
See, otherwise you don't, since you can't see us, we got to identify the voices, you know. So, you know, kind of great. I saw Lauren, what, 2 weeks ago?
That's about right.
2 weeks ago, we were chatting about what we should cover on the radio, and he had done a really good talk for one of the Tea Party groups about why socialism doesn't work and some of the human factors, not just the economic factors, but the human factors that contribute to the, you know, consistent epic fail we see historically. And then the next morning, Bernie Sanders' wife is under investigation.
I heard that. It is so sad.
Yeah. So, you know, even the water carriers for socialism
it's
and
just a mix
all
up
that.
In the books is all. They'll get it all cleared up.
Yeah, she basically lied about how much money they had coming into the college, and then they applied for a loan based on those fabricated numbers, which is, I don't think that's going to work out,
no.
Actually. And it's interesting, the media has forgotten to cover it.
Was it a government loan?
Yeah, for a college.
Oh.
Right.
Yeah.
So, you know, they defrauded basically a private bank. There are no government banks exactly. Okay, I know that.
Let's not get into that.
I know.
Okay.
Hopefully he can get some solace in his three homes.
Yeah, he might.
At least
make bail money.
It's anyway. So that's stunning. So if you haven't followed that, actually, I'll post a link to it on the page for today. You can find us at wethepeopleradio.us, and got a bunch of past shows for you that you might like. Goes back to 2010, and I think the last time we had Lauren on was 2 years ago.
Yeah, 2 years ago when my third book came out.
It was right before The Wizard of Oz, right?
Yeah, it was the introductory show.
That's right, we talked about it.
Because we posted the secret, you know, some of the secret pages from the book.
You got an exclusive on it.
We did.
You were the launching vehicle for that book, which is done very well.
Oh, my gosh, and it's got a lot more book to the book.
Yeah, this is the second edition now. We've already done revisions on it.
Oh, really?
Yeah. No, I mean, the first one, The New Democrat, on the fifth edition, but The New Democrat is already second edition.
The New Democrat, third printing.
These books actually move, believe it or not.
No, they do, and they're really fun. They're the size of Dr. Seuss books. They're little hardback books, just like the books we used to read when we were kids, and I'm sure kids are still reading, but they're the conservative sort of version, I guess, if you will, for grown-ups.
Yeah, they're conservative bedtime stories for grown-ups is what I like to think of them as.
But I like the, okay, do the salon.
Oh, salon.com. That was, I want them to review my other books.
I know, they only reviewed the first one, darn them.
I keep sending them copies. I do. I've been trying to track down this guy, but he said that my first book, The New Democrat, which is basically a parody history of the Obama years, done as the Cat in the Hat, he said it was the most twisted piece of conservative propaganda print matter out there.
And right that, on.
That is now happily on the cover.
It is on the cover, too. Yeah, the most twisted piece of conservative propaganda. That's awesome.
Yeah, no, that was a line.
Yeah, that's you know, that's bragging status right there.
I mean, it was a longer review, but you know, I admitted I saw it. I was scanning through it looking for that line.
Yep.
I knew there would be a jump line in there somewhere that would pop out.
Like, it's this. Huh. Well, it's always nice to know they're reading. You know, other people's things. So, The New Democrat came out, what, like 5 years ago?
Seven. The original.
No kidding?
The original was 2010. And it was right before.
We met you a long time ago.
It was right before the 20. That's been a while. The years go by. It was right before the 2010 election. And now, again, as I said, this is the fifth edition. You know, stuff has happened since then, and we've tried to keep it updated.
That's kind of nice.
Although it's interesting, I never had to really change the structure of the book because it had all the elements in there. And it's like the details have changed. the basic trajectory of the Obama years really did not change from 2010 to 2016.
No, not really. And, of course, Reid and Pelosi as thing one and thing two. Yeah, that was just fun for everybody.
They were perfect. And it is, and I will tell you, honest to goodness, I was saying, and I feel so foolish, I was saying, you know, a couple of years ago, that come 2016, you know, the new Democrat is going to, you know, fade away and we'll, you know, focus on the new books. And that is not what has happened. It remains, you know, this is what, 4 months, 5 months after Obama's left office, it remains the number one seller.
Really?
Yes. It is flying off the shelf to this day. He's not even president anymore. There's something about that book. I mean, I like the others, too. Don't get me wrong.
Right, right. But it does. It reads just like...
Oh, it's a chronology.
It reads just like the Dr. Seuss books, but it has all the...
Most people...
It's even got Glenn Beck in there. I forgot about that.
Yeah, he was the fish.
That's right.
warning everyone about the arrival of the cat. Most people... buy all three books, which I'm happy to report. When I meet, if I run into a new person, they usually get all three. But if somebody says to me, "I'm only going to get one," it's almost always a New Democrat.
No kidding. Fun. And it's a quick read. You know, very much like the Dr. Seuss books. The Wizard of Iz has a lot more. I mean, it's a lot more story.
That's true. It covers a lot more ground too.
It absolutely does.
Quite a few issues.
So, and then the second one. The Gorax, which, of course, you know, how do you go wrong there?
Well, it's an anti-environmentalist parody starring Al Gore as the Lorax character. And it's about how environmentalists are destroying our country for profit.
Imagine that.
Yeah, who'd have thought?
I mean, the people that we... I mean, a lot of our shows are about the, you know, crazy environmentalists and the nutty ideas they have and... how a lot of them aren't based in science and a lot of them don't work and that sort of thing. So I think our listeners would particularly like the Gorax. And your illustrator, do you have a different illustrator now or same person?
Oh, my goodness. You're not supposed to ask that.
Sorry, was that the can of worms? Well, whoever did the illustrations was amazing.
I'm on my second illustrator and I'm working on a fourth book, which is probably going to have a third illustrator. But my goal in all of this, I feel funny saying this, my goal in all of this is to make it so nobody notices that. And we've tried to keep the artwork very consistent.
No, it's really consistent. That's why I guess I was asking.
It's kind of like, you know the TV show Lassie? Yeah. Was on for something like 25 years.
Oh, yeah. Was there 27 different dogs or
something?
Yeah,
they went through a dozen different Lassies, different dogs. And nobody knew, okay? When one of the dogs would pass away, they'd bring in a lookalike and go
one
right
on. One of them
on.
Fell down the well. Like, oh, no, that was Timmy. That was Timmy.
Like nothing happened. So that's kind of my relationship with my illustrators. if no one can tell that I'm doing it right.
I like it.
Yeah.
Because Al Gore looks, I mean, the Lorax guy that's depicted by Al Gore looks just like Al Gore. And actually, in the New Democrat, all the faces on all of the characters are really excellent. And then you get to the third book, The Wizard of Iz. Yeah. I mean, you can just look at the cover and you know who all the people are.
You'll have to go to the website
and go look on that because we can't possibly describe that for you over the air.
It's drtruthbooks, all one word, .com.
Yeah, I was going to, because it used to be like Obama parody or something, but then I realized that link didn't work, so I updated. I was right.
We've broadened. I never thought there was going to be more books. Initially, it was a one-off deal, and that was it.
Isn't that great?
I'm already on my fourth. And I wanted to say also, you know, none of my illustrators have been conservative. I mean, not that they're liberal. They were all so far pretty much apolitical. That is, say, I tell them what to write, and you know, if they don't do it right, I tell them how I want it to be changed. But I think I can say of all three illustrators I've had so far, most of them or none of them actually got most of the jokes.
Really?
These were all blind illustrators. Yeah, yeah. They were people who just are not political. They just have no idea what's going on.
So you told them what to write. That's where the propaganda comes in right there.
So none of them, you know, so a lot of times books like this are done as a collaboration where it's you know, the writer and the illustrator are working together, and that was never the case here. It was I hired them, I paid them to do this illustration, and they're like, whatever you want, you tell me what to draw, I'll draw it.
It's your life.
and I write them a check, and they sign off all rights to it, and it's my baby, not their baby.
So it harkens back to the oldest profession.
Illustration? Maybe that was the oldest. Look at those cave drawings.
That's what she meant.
That could be.
I couldn't help it.
Oh, boy.
I was crying to be said.
Hey, I think we need to take a break, Bob. And when we come back, let's talk about the new one and what that's about.
Yeah, and we don't want to cheat the conversation. We really are going to talk about socialism, but we wanted to definitely make people aware of the books because Lauren speaks all over the country. He lives in real life in
Massachusetts.
Oh, Massachusetts. I always think you live in New Jersey.
Don't say New Jersey.
I'm sorry.
Come on, Massachusetts.
It's the Garden State.
Massachusetts is bad enough.
Yeah. It's travels all over the country, so he's here with us today in Reading. Where, again, 9,000 degrees. We'll be right back.
When they move into your neighborhood, they take over but good. They want you all body and soul. Then it's just your body. Then they go. What shall we do about them? If the black rides
we have a hardback writer in today. Spinoff on the paperback writer.
They're all hardcover.
They're all hardcover books. They're lovely.
And hard to put down and read only once.
Yeah, you know, they're great presents.
Funny stuff.
My dad's getting The Wizard of Oz for Father's Day.
Oh,
sorry, you didn't know that if he's listening.
Yeah.
Surprise is ruined.
We already miss Father's Day?
Yeah.
Okay. Just checking.
Hey.
Well, you are aware that
come on.
Gone.
You're doing this on the Chinese calendar, I see.
It's ruining my fun. That is our guest, Lauren Spivak, who is here today from parts all over America, actually. But he lives in real life in Massachusetts, and he travels the country actually teaching. You know, it always seems like it's just fun stuff, but it's all based on education. And that was your goal at the beginning, right? Just hit the streets? I mean, why did you...
Well, my first goal at the beginning was to just get involved in a positive way in what was happening, because... You know, Barack Obama went from, you know, the first point that anybody ever heard of him outside of, you know, his hometown and becoming president of the United States was one of the shortest periods of time ever. He had a very, very rapid ascent. And I recognized him the minute I saw him because he was every professor I had in college. I mean, this is exactly what I grew up with. Mm-hmm. And I grew up in a college town, and he's just it. There is a certain type that just utterly convinced that they have the secret formula for the entire world, and that there's no argument, and that this is that they're just totally right, and they should just run everybody else's life, and that was Obama. And the minute I saw him, I realized how scary this was, and how much I wanted to get involved in some way. And what it quickly moved into, I suppose if I have, any native talents, one would be a knack for explaining things. So I was always very interested in economics and just the logic of how human societies work. Because the key thing is that people think that socialism versus capitalism is a choice. And that, if you want to be super rich and exploit your workers, then you'll be a capitalist. And if you just want everybody to get along and be and share everything like nice kids in the playground, then you'll be a socialist, and those are the two options. And the fact is that there is no two options. The only option to have anything like an acceptable life for anybody is capitalism, which is what's created the standard of prosperity that we've all come to take for granted, but we shouldn't. And that socialism, as Hayek famously said, is the road to serfdom. Right. It's the road to slavery. It's an utter disaster. So we don't have that choice. And unfortunately, we've got, you know, socialism is all the rage. It wasn't so long ago that if you told a Democrat that the Democrats were socialists, they'd get mad at you.
I did. I told my mom that. And my mom's like, oh, honey, that's just silly.
How could you say such a thing? Now they're, you know, the head of the Democratic National Committee was touring the country with Bernie Sanders, who is not technically a member of the Democratic Party. It was a Democratic Party tour, which included one Democrat and one socialist. They've completely given up the pretense of not being socialist. It's incredibly popular on the college campuses, largely because nobody learns economics and nobody learns history. And I suspect they don't even really pay very much attention to current events. And you put those together, you know, socialism sounds really good. You know, if you ask your five-year-old, what do you think? You know, should we share everything equally, or should we be unequal? You know, your five-year-old says, hey, I guess we should be equal.
Well, better yet, how about five-year-old, how about you don't have to do anything and you get as much as the big kids who did all the work?
Well, yeah, I mean,
and that's the enticement.
It depends how you word it. You know, history and economics and even simple logic show us what an awful, awful idea this is. You know, in Venezuela, which was a middle-class country, it was a perfectly normal, you know, happy middle-class country, big tourist destination, just a couple of years ago, they're hunting squirrels down suburban streets for dinner because the shelves in the grocery store are bare. Okay, this is what you know. 10 years of socialism has gotten them. I mean, they've hit absolute rock bottom, and you know, that's happening right now. You don't have to go to some abstract theory. You don't have to go deep into the history books. It's happening today.
Well, that's the problem, though, is they have forgotten history or haven't read history because it always turns out this way.
How does the left explain the Venezuela phenomenon? Do they just not talk about it?
Well,
I don't hear much about it
The left, and this is, you know, one of the key differences between the left and the right, or at least between the capitalists and the socialists, is that, you know, capitalism believes in a fixed concept that, you know, government is there to protect certain rights like property rights and your right to be free from physical violence and things like that. And that, you know, otherwise we just let it go. They say the capitalist position doesn't really change very much. The socialists basically believe that somebody's vision needs to be imposed on everybody else, whether it's Bernie Sanders' vision or Joseph Stalin's vision or Maduro and Chavez in Venezuela or Castro, you know, that this vision needs to be imposed. And when it doesn't work, what they just blame it on the particular recipe. Mm-hmm. Since socialism is not a fixed thing, it is simply somebody else's opinion being imposed upon you, what they simply say is they did it wrong. So if you ask socialists about Stalin or Castro or Mao, you know, who all murdered people by the millions, you know, and say what happened, they say, well, that was just Stalin. He just did it wrong. But this time,
he was just a bad guy.
That's right. And Mao, he made mistakes too. And but this time, we got the formula right. We perfected it, and this time it's going to work.
Bernie's version is going to bring us to the promised land.
That is right.
Wasn't Venezuela the country that Bernie was touting during the campaign that, you know, had the perfect society and the?
That was mostly Sweden. Seemed like he was.
I think he mentioned Venezuela on their. It was a health care or something. I mean, something about Venezuela was just the utopia.
I know that Michael Moore thought that Cuba's health care was utopia.
Yes.
Yeah. He had a whole movie about that. Where
because they still live in the 1950s where no one actually gets sick because they haven't found most of the diseases yet.
that's where you go to get your ideal medical care.
Yeah.
And your older vehicles.
Sweet rides. Your sweet 56 Chevy.
If you need a new alternator for your 56 Chevy, just go to
Cuba.
The land that time forgot.
And they got the best rebuilders down there.
And over and over and over.
They really do. You're not kidding.
Can you believe those cars are still running? Yeah, good for them.
True story.
Oh, my gosh. So, at the end of the day, how do we talk them out of it? Like, people who actually believe this, are they just gone?
Oh, I don't think so. I think most of the great capitalist theoreticians, the people who really help me understand capitalism, and, you know, and I help other people understand capitalism, the people who help me understand almost all started out as socialists.
Really?
Thomas Sowell said when he was a young man he was a communist. And it's very important. He said he was a communist because he hated the idea of powerful people, you know, stomping on little guy. And that he came to understand that socialism and communism were the systems where the powerful people were stamping on the little guy, and that the only system that gave the little guy a chance was capitalism. So, you know, he kept his primary, you know, instinct, and he simply realized that he was aiming in the wrong direction. And you know, I'm sure you know Thomas Sowell.
Yeah.
He's probably the most brilliant economist alive in the world today. It is an absolute sin that he doesn't have a Nobel Prize, but that's because the Nobel Committee is a bunch of commies. But he totally deserves a Nobel Prize. So he's not the only one. Friedrich Hayek was a socialist before he became a capitalist. So, you know, that when you go to school or an American university, that you get marinated in this nonsense is not a death sentence, and it's not an intellectual death sentence. It's not necessarily over. And most of, you know, and I'll say for myself, you know, I went to public schools and public university in what is arguably one of the most left-wing towns in the entire United States of America. Berkeley, California, and Amherst, Massachusetts, are probably the two most left-wing towns in the entire country, at least by reputation. And I grew up in the second one, and I went to my entire academic career right there. And I heard this stuff all day, which is why I told you I recognize Barack Obama so well. It does not, you know, the truth wins out, or at least it can win out if you're seriously interested in finding it. And the answer in terms of, you know, changing people, I mean, obviously some people, you know, work their own way through this intellectually. But the answer is, first of all, you're not going to do it overnight. You can't just have one argument with a guy and he's going to switch to the other side. It's a long, slow process, but it's a process of explaining and talking to people about how things really work. And people do change all the time, and the battle is never over. Before I ever did this as a career, before the books, before my seminar, before any of that, when I was just a regular working stiff with a regular job in an organization in New York City, I could think of probably a dozen people I worked with over the years who, like everyone in New York, started out as a basic, you know, Democrat / socialist as just a starting point. And I could think of, I could give you a dozen names of people, and they would tell you, if we brought them here, they would say that they're now, you know, capitalists, and they now understand capitalism, and it was because as a coworker, we spent years, you know, working together, and we would chat, we'd talk over lunch, we'd, you know, talk waiting for the subway, and bit by bit, they came to realize that not that they were fundamentally wrong in what they wanted, but that socialism is a lie. It does not give you what it is that it claims to give you. So people who want, you know, opportunity for all and everybody have a chance and have the little guy, you know, free from the oppression of the big guy, the answer is capitalism. And most people don't understand that, but when they do, it's not that hard to swing that door.
And I think that would also explain why these college kids, you know, like you say, being marinated in socialist ideals day in and day out, are the way they are. I think once they get out of that environment and go out and get a job, go out and see how it really is, they'll swing over.
Well, sure, and they also, yeah, it's a good point. They live in a completely artificial environment.
Yes.
You start paying taxes, and it's like, I'll never forget the first time my daughter came home and said, who is FICA, and how did they get all my money?
Well, I just read you that thing on Facebook where it said, teach your children about taxes, buy them an ice cream, and then eat 30% of it.
Yeah, it was a sign at some ice cream store. Which was a brilliant idea. Obviously, that does wise them up a little bit. We need to take a really quick break. When we come back, let's talk about the human problems that prevent the idea of socialism from working, or whatever you called them. What are they, the three?
Well, there are three factors, if you will, about human beings that make socialism not work for human beings. And I'm always very careful about that, because socialism...
I didn't want to misstate.
Socialism could theoretically work for a species other than human beings.
Really
could.
On paper, it really looks great.
So you have that to look forward to. We'll be right back. You're listening to We the People. Join us online, wethepeopleradio.us.
Oh, look. Is that a rainbow?
I'm not going to comment. I didn't have anything nice to say.
Okay.
Yeah. All right. So we're back with our guest, Lawrence Bevec. And,
hey, while we were on the
break. Okay, yes.
Yeah, we were talking about...
Talk about the break again.
About history. And I asked Lauren, how in these colleges and universities, how do these professors get around history and support their views with regards to the past and what these, you know, previous socialist leaders have done? How do they get around that?
Well, there's two points I guess I would make. The first, I was mentioning that I was the convention speaker at the Republican Liberty Caucus in Orlando earlier this year, and I got to share the podium with Tom Woods, who has been a big hero of mine for a long time, and that was very neat. And he said something interesting. He said, you know, he's a history professor. He said when the undergraduates show up in college, their entire knowledge of history, the entirety of their historical knowledge, pretty much boils down to Lincoln freed the slaves and Hitler killed the Jews. And that's it. There's nothing else. Nothing else in the entire history of planet Earth are they aware of. And you know, and he's spot on. I mean, I think deep down we understand this. Go grab the next, you know, three young people walking down the street outside the studio and ask them, and that's all you're going to get. That's all they've got. So history, the left doesn't like history.
No, they can't.
History is bad.
Sure.
History is a bunch of bad, bad, bad people who were racist and sexist and homophobic, and they didn't even have transgender bathroom privileges. and this is, yeah, this is bad stuff. And so that's their view, that, you know, we are perfect. We're not perfect. We're at least, you know, way above all of our ancestors, which, by the way, this is actually a really important point, if I'll digress for just a second here, because the conservative worldview is to some extent to idolize our ancestors, or at least certain amongst our ancestors. When we say, you know, well, the founding fathers, you know, in their wisdom gave us the Constitution and gave us this limited government and did these things, and we're looking up to them, it's very important to understand that the young person who's college educated today, that makes absolutely no sense to them, because they've been taught that our ancestors were bad, bad, despicable people.
Yeah.
All of them. And so if you say that, you know, anything, you know, that our ancestors passed down to us is worth preserving, their gut reaction is it can't be worth preserving because they were despicable people. So this is a, you know, this is a crucial argument that we're having as to whether our ancestors are admirable or despicable. And that's a huge determinant on where you think from that point on. If the Constitution is written by a bunch of racist, sexist, slave-holding, you know, bad people, what do we need it for? Get rid of it.
Well, how could it possibly be?
Let's toss that in the garbage.
Yeah, you know, that's a good point.
So that is about one half of it. The other half is that to the extent that anything is being taught, it's progressive history, which basically boils down to this. Every single step of American history, you find disputes over, you know, whether the government should be bigger or smaller. And the way that history is taught pretty much universally in the United States today is that the people who did not want government to grow were idiots. They say it's every chapter, whether it's between the Federalists and the Anti-Federalists, or around the Civil War, or the Progressive Era, or the income tax, you know, whatever it is, that you have these idiots who don't understand that it's always good to increase government. And then each one's a little story, and the happy end of the story is that the good government-increasing people managed to outsmart the stupid troglodyte, you know, small government people, and we got an income tax.
That is so true.
The income, to take one example out of a thousand we could come up with, but the income tax amendment, the 16th Amendment, I mean, that's, you know, no teacher I ever had from high school through college explained this in any other way other than this was just good, and a bunch of morons were against. How could you be against an income tax? I mean, really, what a wonderful idea. It allows the government to grow pretty much limitlessly. I mean, what could be wrong with that?
Well, same too with Social Security.
Sure. And again, and the New Deal.
All these calls, you know, people will say, well, I can't live on Social Security. There's not enough money. I need more.
Like that's
and it's like, okay, well, that wasn't the original idea and probably where we kind of went off the trail.
And the whole New Deal, by the way, is another fascinating example because by any objective viewing, the New Deal was a colossal failure. It absolutely, positively failed. That is to say, in the entire 30, so Roosevelt gets elected in 32, okay, by the end of the 30s, okay, and again, he was in there for what, 13, 14 years? Okay, the longest person who's ever president, okay, but now World War II is a different story, but by the end of the 30s, the unemployment rate was still 20%. I mean, we call the Great Recession of 2008 because it got up to 10.5%. This was a 20%, and this was years, and he controlled the Congress, and everything he wanted went through. He got his justices on the Supreme Court. All of these crazy unconstitutional things, the NRA and the Civilian Conservation Corps, and all of these alphabet soup, everything Roosevelt wanted got through, and the economy was an absolute disaster area. Now, the unemployment finally ended with World War II, because we drafted everybody.
Because everybody had an automatic job.
That, you know, we could end unemployment right now, just draft. If you're unemployed, in the Army. Okay, you'll end it like that.
But see, they don't teach that. They just don't teach that.
No, they teach it as it were a success.
That's what I mean.
And if you ask your teacher, you know, how come the unemployment rate was 20% after 8 years of this?
Imagine if it was 20% today.
Yeah, there'd be riots in the streets.
Oh, my gosh.
And your teacher will say, well, yeah, hadn't quite, you know, God congealed. Quite the right way. It was still just, you know, it was an utter failure. And yet, your history teacher, your history professor, your history book will not say that. Roosevelt is constantly presented as the hero who saved us from the Great Depression. And he did no such thing. In fact, he largely caused it. The Great Depression was started out as a kind of a hiccup in the stock market. It was the actions of government, and it's very clear to demonstrate this, was the actions of government that dragged it out, you know, for an entire decade. And it was somewhat Hoover's fault, and it was even more Roosevelt's fault. Did you know there was a recession in 1920? that no one ever teaches in history class. 1920, there was a recession, and you know what the government did? This was like Harding and Coolidge. You know what they did? They cut the federal budget. They said, we're having a recession, we better shrink the government. So they cut all the federal expenditures. The recession was over in 6 months. And the economy started booming.
No wonder we don't talk about that.
In what we now call the Roaring Twenties.
We break for this new message. No, we can't talk about that. We shrink government.
News alert. And things
start getting better.
So Roosevelt does the exact opposite 10 years later, and this time it drags out for 10 years until the very start of World War II when we draft everybody. You couldn't have two clearer examples. By the way, the Great Depression ended in Canada, because it was a worldwide depression. It ended in Canada years before it ended in the United States, largely because they didn't have a New Deal. They didn't have Roosevelt. I mean, the historical...
Didn't have all that help?
Yeah, that's right.
Stop helping me.
The government wasn't doing all of these things to fix it. And, nobody ever talks about this. And to this day, Roosevelt is one of these presidents. He's like Lincoln and Washington. You can't say anything bad about him, you know, because he saved us from the Great Depression. He did no such thing. You know, it's like there's a point where they're spinning and there's a point where they're just lying. And my history teachers were lying to me about that, because they clearly wanted everything to conform to their vision. But you know, you'll get the same thing in the history books. If you look at the 60s and the Great Society programs, okay, the people who oppose them are troglodytes or are cavemen, and fortunately the good guys won, and we have a whole new batch of socialist programs coming out of Washington. So that's the progressive model of history, you know, that it's bad, bad, bad in every single thing, unless we're going back. You see,
right.
if you don't like any of this, you're going backwards. We can't go backwards. We've got to go forwards. What does even that even mean? It means
we have to do it again because
it means more government versus less government. It's all it's ever meant.
Do you think it's ever been this bad before? I mean, as far as the economy. Obviously, we've gone through the Great Depression, but as far as the discourse in today's society, you think it's ever been as bad as it is today?
Okay, you mean what, the divisions
yes.
in today's society? Oh, I'm sure it has.
I mean, we had a civil war.
That was a pretty bad example. And it's worth noting, as some historians will, that politics in the 19th century. Had a viciousness to it that made Trump versus Hillary Clinton, you know, look like a friendly game of badminton. When it was John Adams, you know, versus Thomas Jefferson in 1800, you know, they were accusing each other of whoring. They were accusing each other of having illegitimate children. They were accused. The pamphlets of that era. There was like nothing that you would not accuse your political opponent of. And the newspapers at the time were almost all partisan. There was newspapers
just like now.
Now they had
fake news in the 1800s.
So the newspapers on the two sides would write these articles that, you know, Thomas Jefferson was caught in a whorehouse yet again. He just can't control it.
Whoremonger!
They just sat there making this stuff up, just throwing the sling mud back and forth at each other. So, you know, certainly...
So the guys now just really aren't trying, because they're not coming up with anything that funny.
Really. Yeah, we've heard that before.
Yeah.
So the divisions have been there. I mean, from the 40s into the early 60s, there was a tremendous amount of harmony in American politics, and if you take in American culture, really, if you take that as a baseline, you know, we're getting worse and worse and worse and worse. But you have to go to the 19th century to find a thing where it was even worse than that. You know, if you watch today the Kennedy-Nixon debates of 1960, the most striking thing to me is there was not a dime's worth of difference in terms of what they actually stood for. You know, you may have liked one personality more than the other, but what Kennedy proposed to do as president, what Nixon proposed to do as president, you'd need a microscope to figure out what the difference was. There was essentially no difference between Democrats and Republicans for about 20 years there.
Well, they say if Kennedy was alive today, he'd be a hardcore conservative. I mean, when you look at his policies.
Probably.
Yeah. It has changed a lot.
But that's progressivism.
Yes.
You see, anyone who came before today has to be bad. Because we're up to today. You know, Hillary Clinton, you know, was against gay marriage. In fact, so was Barack Obama for the first term.
Husband was against illegal immigration.
That's right.
I mean, gave some fairly striking speeches that would now be booed off the stage.
But progressivism is a train rolling down the tracks, you know, at 80 miles an hour,
with no direction, really.
That's right. But if you're not, you know, if you're not as fast as the train, you know, you're already left in the dust of history, according to them.
It's got that Thelma and Louise ending all baked in. We're going to take a really quick break, and I swear we are going to talk about the original thing we were going to talk about. We're going to stay here all day. We'll get to it. We're going to keep people captive. Oh, you're listening to We the People. We're here with Lauren Spivak. He is the author of The Gorax and The Wizard of Iz. Oh, I'm cheating Bob out of music. Okay, turn it up, Bob.
It's a wonder I can think at all. And my lack of education hasn't hurt enough. I can read the writing on the wall. Hold a throne, but give us the nice bright colors. Give us the green for summers. Makes you think all the world for a sunny day. Oh yeah, I got an iPhone camera. I love to take a photograph. So mama, don't take.
Gosh, that's interesting considering what we were talking about during the break. Mattress Mary rides again. All right. So, at the end of the day, socialism is a bust for, you gave us three reasons. We have like 5 minutes, so give us those and we'll talk about them in detail next hour. That way we have made a commitment to our listeners.
Sure. This is all about being human. You know, people think that economics is about math, and it's incredibly important to understand that it's not about math. It's about human beings. You can make all kinds of mathematical things work. You know, if we slide some money this way and that way,
look at global warming.
Yeah, it looks great on a piece of paper or in your spreadsheet. But when you're talking about human beings, you have to deal with three realities. One is the whole issue of the future, which is a uniquely human issue. No other animal, dogs and cats and goats and wild turkeys, do not think about the future. And they don't really have a future in the sense that the future is no different than the present.
Right.
You know, you live this, if you are a wild turkey, your life is the same as your parents, and your kids' life will be the same as their grandparents. Human beings, it's all about the future and predicting the future. And there is no, we all want to predict the future, and nobody can tell for sure. And if we could predict the future, socialism might actually work. And that's the first one. And the second one is that we are greedy and lazy, we humans. And we're other things, too. You know, no one's suggesting that, you know, that's all we are.
We're not only greedy and lazy.
Yeah, sure, we're generous, we're industrious, we're lots of things. We're very complex, we humans. But a certain amount of greed and a certain amount of laziness is part of the human makeup, and it's pretty absurd to argue that it's not there. Now, it's worth noting that Karl Marx, specifically says that laziness will end the day socialism starts. And this is very important because he has to say this because his theory doesn't work without this. It's important to note these details. It's important that, you know, and, I mean, of course, it's absurd to say that people are going to suddenly be different because of socialism. But he says that. He says work will become a pleasure. He says once socialism comes in, everyone will start to love work so much that they'll just run to be the first one at work, and they'll work really, really hard, and they'll want to stay late every single day because of they're not getting paid anymore. Everyone gets paid the same, right. But socialism. But work will become pleasurable, and then everyone will do it, and there won't be any problems at all. Yeah, that's very nice. You know, if you accept that,
so you get down to the pay part, and people are not
well. But again, you cannot change.
change, although he's saying you can, he's simply wrong. I mean, Marx was this kind of crazy, you know, visionary who he's like a prophet who just says things like, oh, well, capitalism will turn into... Because why? I mean, because you say so? So he just says things that are supposed to be taken like some oracle, you know, the Oracle of Delphi, you know, spewed out this tidbit of wisdom. But it's rubbish, and that's the second reason. The greed and laziness are not going to go away. Capitalism has a way of dealing with greed and laziness, and socialism does not deal with it very well. And that is a reality that won't go away. And the third is a huge issue in economics that gets way too little attention, is the complexity of a modern economy. See, socialism, probably our instinct to like socialism, at least in its ideas, probably goes back to primitive man who lived in small little tribal groups, which were little more than extended families. And it was possible for everyone to pretty much understand everything that was going on within this tiny hunter-gatherer community.
Yeah, everybody had a job, everybody did their job, everybody was happy.
And everybody knew everybody. The chief of the tribe, which was probably everybody's grandfather, you know, knew the different people. He knew who he could rely on, who he couldn't rely on. He knew what everybody needed and what they wanted and what their goals were. And in that circumstance, the best thing to do is all work together and do what the chief says, because we're going to rise or fall together. In a modern society, it's frankly just too complicated. Our individual brains are no bigger than those brains were back when we were the hunter gatherers, you know, with the chief and the tribe. And the economy is a billion trillion times more complicated. And so what socialism inevitably does, because it's one person's vision imposed on all of society, capitalism allows everyone to have their own vision. Mm-hmm. In socialism, there's one guy's vision. You know, socialists don't think about it that way, but that's what it is. Right. Instead of my having my vision of my life and you having your vision of your life, we all have to live Bernie Sanders' vision of our lives.
Right, right.
And what it does is it creates essentially an intellectual traffic jam. It's kind of as if every single street in America had to go through one little, you know, stoplight in somewhere in Iowa. And you'd have traffic backed up for 1,000 miles, because there's no way that Bernie Sanders or Stalin or Mao or whoever the leader is can understand everything that's going on.
And there are all sorts of things besides that we'll discuss next hour.
Like opportunity and people wanting to go a different direction.
Well, I was going to say, like, people who are willing to agree with that.
Yeah.
And stifles innovation and all that good stuff. So we'll hit that next hour. We're here with Lawrence Bivak. He is the author of The New Democrat, The Gorax, and the most recent, The Wizard of Iz. And you can see all of those on his website, drtruthbooks.com, drtruthbooks.com. And you can find us at We the People. We hope you'll join next hour, wethepeopleradio.us.